Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
Well, spring is just around the corner for us in the Southern Hemisphere, and for those of you that live in the Northern Hemisphere, you will probably have found out that autumn is just around the corner, which means that allergy season, whether you're living in the Southern Hemisphere or the Northern Hemisphere, is probably about to hit with a vengeance. And for those of you who suffer from allergies, whether respiratory or any kind of other seasonal allergies, this is not a good time of the year, and suddenly the antihistamines come out and all sorts of tissues are lying around the house over the next couple of weeks. So that is the theme of our podcast today. We're going to be talking to a specialist allergologist who talks very specifically about the challenges that athletes face when it comes to allergies, and also some of the modern treatments that we're going to be dealing with. But before we get on to that, Ross Tucker, as usual, with me here in our studio in Cape Town, and some very interesting caught my eyes for us this week, in particular one Nairo Quintana.
Yeah, the first ever tramadol ban. Well, not ban, actually, because he could race. First ever tramadol positive, let's call it that.
Because I asked you whether it was a ban or a disqualification, but it was a disqualification.
It's the latter, and the big debate is why is it that and not a ban? Yeah. I lapsed into saying ban myself now, because I think most people who are opposed to doping automatically say, well, okay, it's a substance I took. We know that it's been used in the sports. We know that it potentially has performance-enhancing benefits. That's debatable. We'll talk about that. And so why is he not disqualified and banned like he would be if he failed a test for EPO, or testosterone, a growth hormone? And so that's been the big talking point. And a couple of you picked this up on Patreon. Peter Frost was one of you. Renato Cironi also. So thanks for those. The patrons have been, again, very talkative. And I've had a lot of interaction in the last week or two. So that's been really great. Keep it coming. But yeah, this one, as I mentioned, it's the first time that an athlete has tested positive for tramadol. It can only happen in cycling, which is one of the ways that it's unique.
It's always in cycling, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. I was listening to The Move because they did a preview of the Vuelta, and they did that on the eve of the race, and this came up.
It's Lance Armstrong and his crew.
And it's really interesting for me, like as someone who's campaigns against doping, and my default would be that this is doping. Mm. To listen to them dismiss it as clickbait and a non-story. So you couldn't get two more diametrically opposed viewpoints. I listened to that and I said, pretty interesting preparing for this.
So they're saying that the ban is ridiculous.
Well, not ban. They're saying the disqualification. So the guy who hosts it, that JB, what's his surname?
I forget his name now, but JB, he's with Lance. Yeah.
He said, he's in the media. So this is, he's you, basically. He says, I'm in the media, and I'll tell you what's happening here, is that they want a sensational story. And so it's a clickbait headline. I'm listening to this thinking like, it's a rule violation. There's literally a policy document that the UCI has written. And I want to read to you from that. And
he was disqualified.
Yes.
It's not like nothing happened to him.
This is not like someone's fabricating the. Yes. I mean, so there's literally a document that was released in March. It became into effect. This is a document, part 13 of a UCI regulation, version entering to force 1st of March 2020. And on page 24, they explain this tramadol policy. They describe what tramadol is, how the control works. But there's a paragraph here, and it literally says, by requesting a license, any rider agrees to abide and be bound by these rules and explicitly agrees and acknowledges that tramadol is prohibited in competition. In this respect, any rider agrees to submit to an in-competition tramadol control as provided under this chapter. And the way that works is that they actually have a dedicated area at the finish line of every stage, and it's called the Tramadol Control Center. And a rider is notified that they have to go to this, and they provide a finger prick sample. It's not a blood draw and it's not a urine sample. That's also different here. It's a finger prick that gets blotted onto a little piece of paper, and that's where they look for the tramadol or its metabolite. So that's also different, right? And if they find tramadol or one of its metabolites in there, then you have violated a rule. It's a policy violation. So you can't call it a clickbait thing and say Quintana is not guilty of anything. Now, he might well challenge the protocol, the policy, the blood dot method, chain of custody, procedural stuff, right? The thing is, he's failed it twice in the same race, right? Mm. The one was on the 8th of July and the other one's the 13th, 5 days apart. The half-life of tramadol is short enough that that can't be the same ingestion. It's not like 2 days where you could argue it was, I took it once or didn't take it once. He has to prove that he didn't take it twice.
Can you just take a step back? What is tramadol?
So tramadol is an opioid painkiller. Many of you listening to this have probably taken it at some stage. Certainly Peter and Renato mentioned that they'd used it. And it's sold under different brand names, but they test for the molecule that is contained within tramadol. And it's a controversial drug because since 2012, so now we go back a decade, it's been on what WADA call the monitoring list. So it's a substance that they're aware of with the potential for abuse and doping, but doesn't qualify to make it onto the banned list, and so instead they monitor it. Meldonium, you may recall, Sharapova's drug, that was on the monitoring list for a long time, then they put it on the banned list. Nicotine, caffeine is also on that list. So tramadol's been on that list for a decade, and various bodies have tried to persuade WADA to move it onto the banned list. I'm looking here at a website from the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency that was published in February 2017, so 5.5 years ago. Headline, Tramadol, Why Some Athletes and Anti-Doping Expert Want It Banned. And they talk about how it's a still legal substance that is powerful and dangerous. And USADA, alongside numerous other organizations in sport, believe that the time is now for WADA to finally move the drug from its monitoring program, where it's been since 2012, to the prohibited list alongside 12 other narcotics that are already banned in competition. Now, when you go to the banned substance list, you will find a section, S7, for banned narcotics. And they include drugs you may know, diamorphine, which is heroin, fentanyl, very powerful drug that's killed a lot of celebrities, you may know from that reason, methadone, morphine, oxycodone, oxymorphine. So these substances are already banned, and different bodies have said, well, tramadol needs to be on that list.
So it's a heavy painkiller.
It's a pretty strong painkiller. I mean, I remember getting it once and I was at the hospital and they said to me, they said, if you take this now, you spend the night. You don't drive or someone fetches you.
Wow.
So they wouldn't let me get in the car and drive myself home if I took it because the side effects are thought to be dizziness, drowsiness, lack of coordination, concentration, and so forth.
Which so it's is not just taking a couple of
you know the old warning, do not operate heavy machinery? That's the tramadol thing.
So it's not a couple of aspirins, basically?
No, it's not. So in South Africa, I can't speak for the rest of the world, but it's an S5 drug, the Schedule 5 painkiller, which is right up there. I mean, this is prescription-only stuff. And it's been, as I say, it's been on the radar for quite a long time. Now, it's in 2017, also at the time that USADA was lobbying, the Director General of WADA, Oliver Nigley, said the following. We have a committee of experts. We have a process for putting out the list every year, which is determined by experts. They discussed it, tramadol, at length, and their conclusion was it didn't meet the criteria to be put on the list. We have a process for the list. We have the relevant knowledge, and we have to rely on our experts and their conclusions. So, for whatever reason, they've decided that it doesn't qualify to move from monitoring into banned. Now, that's contentious. Mm. But the UCI, driven in part by data, have decided that it is worth putting on their list. And the reason I think they've done that is because in the monitoring, obviously what WADA is doing is they're testing samples at various different events. Not always, but they're often testing samples. They're looking for tramadol. And between 2012 and 2015, 75% roughly of all tramadol positives in sport were coming from cycling. So they're saying, well, this painkiller has the potential for abuse, and the specific sport in which it's being used the most based on our data is cycling.
So I'm just guessing here, but I imagine that if you're taking this substance, things like the pain that you would feel riding up a climb, for instance, any kind of pain, or even if you're suffering from back pain from 3 weeks in the saddle kind of thing, it would reduce the effects of things like that.
Now, that's where this expert group that Oliver Nigley talks about is probably having most of their discussions, because you know, first reaction is, well, okay, it's a painkiller. It numbs pain. Pain is limiting to performance. Mm. I mean, we all know whether you're a Tour de France podium contender or a hacker like we are, pain on a climb slows you down.
Yeah.
You slow down because you're in pain. So in theory, the removal of pain is performance enhancing.
Mm.
In practice, studies haven't found that conclusively yet, but we'll get onto that in a moment. But I think that those experts from anti-doping are saying, right, well, here's a drug. Yes, it's a painkiller. Yes, it has side effects. It's regulated as medicine. And we're going to trust the doctors to regulate its use in cyclists. In other words, not give it unnecessarily. Because at the moment, we either don't think the performance-enhancing benefits are large enough or the harms are large enough to justify putting it on the banned list. Because, and we discussed this, what was it, 3 or 4 podcasts back, the whole ethics of doping.
And the whole Rafa Nadal story.
Right. Yeah. Now, to me, if I'm a cyclist and I use tramadol to dull the pain of cycling, that is unequivocally doping. Because I didn't need it for any reason other than the fact that I'm about to induce pain through sport, and I'm going to try and switch that off.
Mm.
Would you agree? I mean, my intent is performance enhancement using a drug.
Yes.
It's doping.
Unless he would justify it by saying, as we've heard in the past with the Nadal story, was there was some bodily pain that needed to be treated by it. So in other words, if Quintana was suffering from back pain, he might say, well, I needed it for back pain.
And that's where, so John Pike, who's a sports ethicist that we've worked with a little bit on World Rugby, has written a piece in which he would probably make the distinction that if that's the reason and you use it, it's not doping. But if you used it in the absence of clinical pain, for want of a better word, sports pain, that qualifies as doping. So now we're having a theoretical discussion about tramadol, which is probably important.
But there is a line there.
But that's the point. There's a line, and it's not a line that's understood by people in the sport. It's a line that's literally written in black and white. So when a cyclist applies for a license, he agrees to these terms.
Mm.
And so if that substance is in your urine, or not in your urine, in your little finger prick blood spot, then it's not clickbait. It's not a nothing story. It's not a made up controversy. Mm. It's a violation, but not a doping violation.
But Quintana, if he'd taken the substance knowingly, knows full well that he's risking being caught.
He's either negligent and he doesn't know this policy,
right,
or he's doing it knowing it. Mm-hmm. Okay, he's denying it, right? So I suppose we've got to put that in there. So he's got to explain how it got into his blood twice. But so now the next thing is, some people say, well, it's just semantics. It's doping. Well, by wording, it's not doping because it's a policy violation, not a doping violation.
Mm.
Because the UCI, and I actually think they've been criticized here, people saying, oh, they make it difficult for themselves. I think this is actually good of them to do. If they're aware that there's a prescription painkiller problem in the sport, they should be taking steps to try and clamp down on it. You know, it's happened before. It's happened with the intravenous injections, fluid and so on. But the thing about this, where people have to understand, like, sports governance, is that WADA exists in part to protect sports bodies from the litigation that arises out of these tests, positive tests. If you go back to the 1990s, Butch Reynolds was a 400 meter runner from the US, and he failed the drugs test. And that his legal challenge to that against US anti-doping was part of what created WADA, because everyone recognized this almost the safety in numbers that WADA would create. So sports bodies are very reluctant to list as doping substances that WADA doesn't list. They want to hide under the umbrella of WADA, if that makes sense.
Right, yeah.
So when the UCI recognized this issue, they wanted it banned, and we see this from US anti-doping as well. WADA has said no. So the UCI said, well, fine, we're not going to call it doping, but we're still going to ban it in competition. That's how they've created this. In a sense, it's like a reverse loophole. They've tightened a loophole. Only in cycling. So again, no one else could fail this test in tramadol except a cyclist. And now people can argue about whether that's unnecessary, necessary, or not, controversial or whatever. But that's how we've gotten to the situation.
And you said right at the start, this is the first tramadol disqualification that I've heard of. Yeah, I mean, it's quite a rare thing because it's unusual. So you can imagine that's why it's creating so much controversy. And I've seen stories about him. He's gone back. He's not doing the Vuelta. Yeah. He's
and it's
going
a name,
back to
right? I mean, this is a Grand Tour winner. Oh, yeah. It's one of the great cyclists of the last 15 years or whatever.
Exactly.
Sixth in the Tour, I think he was.
Yeah.
And just again, referring back to that policy, in light of the foregoing, which is to say the risk of dependence and addiction, commonly reported adverse side effects are dizziness, drowsiness, loss of attention, which are incompatible with cycling and endanger other competitors. Fair enough. In order to protect each rider's health and physical integrity, tramadol is prohibited in competition. But now, again, they couldn't take the big step of banning it as doping. So they banned it as a policy violation, effectively, with its own regulation. And that's why, for a first offense, it's disqualification and a fine. So I think it was 5,000 Swiss francs that Quintana pays, disqualification, and he pays the costs for the tramadol control, which I imagine are fairly small. A multiple violation, and incidentally, he's lucky they don't treat two in the same race as multiple violations, because it's clearly two different samples. Causes disqualification, 5 month suspension, and then a third infringement is 9 months. So eventually you do get suspensions. But again, they're not traditional doping violation suspensions. They're policy medical regulation violations instead. And that's for all the criticism of the UCI, I would back them on this.
It's one of those things where it's defining what doping is, isn't it? Because doping we always assume is what defines performance enhancing, I guess. And it's hard to I always think that doping is kind of almost like a slang term for all these wide range of things, but this isn't doping, it's medical assistance.
Yes, I don't know whether you can get a TUE for tramadol. Let's say you do have back pain. Apply for a therapeutic use exemption, use it, have it come up in your blood spot test, but be cleared on the basis of the TUE? If so, then a cyclist really has no excuse, because then even if he's got a legitimate source of what I'm calling clinical pain, he's still used it off-label without declaring it for that thing that it should have been used for in the first place, right? So, to me, again, if I'm taking a substance to block something that inhibits performance, i.e. sports pain, then that qualifies in my mind as intentional doping.
Yeah.
And I'd believe, and we've seen testimony, by the way. Michael Barry used to ride for USPS, I think it was Team Sky, I forget now. And sorry, it was Jonathan Tin and Locke was Sky. Michael Barry was US Postal. And there was also a Dutch cyclist whose name I now forget. I'll post a link in the show notes, apologies. They all report how this used to be commonly handed out in the race, on the bus, before the stage, in the last sort of 20, 30Ks. It was part of the old finishing bottle, because that's when you know that you're going to need to access every reserve you have. Pain stops you from accessing reserves, so therefore the finishing bottle needed to have painkillers. And that Dutch cycle, Leo Venstra, I forget, sorry, my name memory is poor. He spoke about the idea that it's legal and it improves performance, so of course I'm using it. Every cyclist would do the same thing.
Because if it's legal, you're going to push the limits of what you can take. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, on the study side of things, there are four studies that I'm aware of, and there's an article in a journal called Frontiers in Pharmacology, written by Thomas Zandanai and some colleagues from Spain, in which they discuss tramadol, including its prevalence and where it's been used and what it does. And they describe four studies. Now, one of those studies found a 5% improvement in performance over a 20-minute time trial. The other three studies found no benefit. And the moment you add, and it's interesting, they add cognitive challenges to exercise, any physical benefit goes away, which is an interesting model. So I suppose one could argue that there's no evidence that it should be banned. But in my mind, if I'm, especially in a grand tour where the cumulative effects of hard efforts creates pain, you know, you wake up on the 10th, 11th, 12th day of a Tour de France, I would imagine, with significant muscle soreness and weakness and aches and pains. Removing those is theoretically performance enhancing. And so I don't think a drug would persist in the peloton if it wasn't beneficial for them.
And I guess anything, I mean, this is what makes it interesting, because if you say that any kind of pain medication is therefore feasible, that's what I find very confusing about this whole story, is that they're saying you can't take pain medication. In other words, can you take no pain medication at all? And if you can, to what extent can you? In other words, could you take a Disprin? Could you take a...
Well, yes, those are allowed, because the
paracetamol. You can take those.
Yeah, because they're just not powerful enough to. Yeah. So, but yeah, this is the gray line, which at some point becomes a black line, and then over which you enter into doping.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, where do we put that line?
And tramadol sounds like it's getting closer and closer to that black line.
Yeah, and the UCI has drawn a line further along than the WADA is prepared to.
Yeah.
And that's what's causing the confusion among some people about this. Yeah. It would be really fascinating to be in those meetings and listen to why WADA is rejecting not applications, but lobbying by UCI, USADA. There's that movement, MPCC, for credible cycling. They've been big vocal advocates for tramadol ban in the sport. And WADA must have their reasons for not wanting to do it. One of them probably is what we discussed a couple of weeks back, where if you put all these substances on the banned list, you're effectively denying athletes what a non-athlete would have regular access to for necessary reasons.
Mm.
And so that's the problem. I mean, it's going to be fascinating to hear what he takes to the court.
Yeah.
Because one sample procedurally, okay, fine. But you've got to show that they made similar mistakes twice, chain of custody or whatever it is. I mean, you can't, yeah, I suppose you could argue for accidental ingestion.
Yeah.
But inadvertent doping, I suppose. I don't know. It's just going to be really interesting to hear what comes out of that. So, yeah, interesting, no doubt.
Right, so we'll see how that rolls out. I must be honest, I'm quite sad to see Nairo Quintana being cuffed for this, because he's one of the great sort of heroes of the Tour de France over the last few years. Always puts in a very brave performance on all the climbs, and you always think that he's one of those riders who gives it absolutely everything on the course, and he had quite a good tour this year. So it's kind of sad that if he's being disqualified.
One last thought, actually. There's another paper I found. It comes out of Italy. It was published in 2014. It's a little bit older now. It's called Dietary Supplements and Drug Use and Doping Knowledge in Italian Young Elite Cyclists. And so what they did here was they took 40 elite youth cyclists, so aged between 19 and 23, so sort of in that age category. And they asked them about their attitudes and perceptions and knowledge of supplements. And what was interesting is that they overwhelmingly identified tramadol as doping. Even though it's not.
Yes.
So the cyclists themselves felt that it was doping. And then, funnily enough, they failed to recognize certain other substances that are doping as doping. So, okay, so there's a bit of a knowledge gap in both directions. And then the last word on this is that it says here, participants deemed doping prevalence high among cyclists in general, but not in their own team. which I read, and they even have a p-value here for significance, and it's less than 0.0001. So it's highly significant that these elite youth cyclists think that lots of doping happens, but not our guys.
Yes,
which is a classic human condition, where everyone dopes except us.
Yes,
and exactly. But anyway, that study
must be a psychological term for that.
There's got to be some sort of dissonance thing going on there. But anyway, the point was that the cyclists themselves think that tramadol is doping, even though it isn't.
Yeah.
Although, remember, this was 2014. It wasn't even named by UCI yet as a prohibited in competition. So, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see if by 2023, you know, next year this time, there's been any movements on tramadol, whether one case for a big name pushes it over, or perhaps actually makes it less likely to go on, because everyone says, hang on, too grey, too ethically dubious. Mm. Who knows?
Well, according to the story on, I think it's on Cycling News today, it's talking about his lawyer, Nairo Quintana's lawyer, saying that they described the UCI's tramadol systems as very strange and called on the UCI's rules and processes into question. That's obviously what they're focusing on.
I don't know what that means.
It must be the processes in which they are taking those samples, I'd imagine.
This blood spot method, I remember, because part of the work I do with World Rugby on the scientific committee is to look at proposals. And we got a proposal from some researchers who wanted to study this blood spot method in rugby. And in the end, I don't believe it was funded for various other reasons. But it was clearly coming along as a new cost-effective way of doing sampling, because you could test a lot of people for the same cost that you would normally test one person.
Yeah.
And maybe the fact that it's novel in that way is what's going to be questioned here. I don't know. But pharmacologically, analytically, I don't believe there's a problem with the spot method. I suppose the you know, one interesting issue is, you know, normally a urine or a blood sample, you can request a second analysis of the B sample.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they do two samples at a time of the finger prick one. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole blood spot method and there's a whole tramadol issue that needs to probably be discussed. So it will be interesting. We'll probably be revisiting this at some point in the future.
Well, we'll keep a close eye on that. And I'm sure if all of those you involved in that side of cycling will be interested to see all the updates coming from his team and his lawyers, because it looks like Nairo Quintana will be fighting this case. Anyway, so let's move on to our topic of the day. And very happy to welcome Professor Claudia Gray, who is a specialist allergologist and pediatrician from the University of Cape Town and the Kids Allergy Center at the Vincent Pilotti here in Cape Town. She was also one of the founding directors of the Allergy Foundation of South Africa, and she's also a fellow of the American Academy of Allergy and Clinical Immunology and a member of the European Academy of Allergy and Clinical Immunology.
Immunology.
There we go. Got to be careful what I say there. So, I mean, Claudia was fascinating. We brought her into the discussion today because we wanted to find out, first of all, about the prevalence of allergies among sports people, and we're talking particularly around sports, what the latest updates in terms of treatments were, and whether some of the allergies that we all suffer from to some extent are both treatable in the long term, and if the current methodologies of treating those things is the same as it always has been. There was quite a lot of interesting stuff that I didn't know came out of this conversation.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I feel like we knew this a little bit before, but we've quantified it in our interview there, is that if you don't suffer from some kind of airway issue at some point in the year, you're probably in the minority.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not to say if more than half of us have asthma. That's the most common one people think of when they think about breathing issues and respiratory issues. But lower airway dysfunction is one of many different conditions and allergies and so forth, pollens and so on. And they're so common.
Mm.
Yet, I mean, I certainly haven't ever really thought about understanding whether I have one. Maybe I just accept that I can't breathe because I think I'm less fit than I am. Mm-hmm. Who knows?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting to then pick the brains of someone who understands this and can explain it. And hopefully when people hear this, they'll either understand what they experience or will be able to explore some new things that they hadn't considered before.
Yeah. So very, very interesting. Here is Dr. Claudia Gray.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Right, so welcome to Dr. Claudia Gray, who is visiting us all the way up the road, actually, because she works very close to us here to our podcasting center. Claudia, welcome. And this is a subject which has kind of come via the via, because you and I have a mutual friend and a guy called Charlie Wright, who runs a business called Clean My Bed, which deals with taking out dust mites out of beds and that kind of thing. And he suggested we chat to you a little bit about, particularly on the allergy side. Now, being a podcast about sport, we're obviously very interested in the, on the sports side. Looking at your expertise in this area, the big question is allergies more prevalent in athletes than it is in the normal population? Do we know?
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, that's a very interesting question to start with. And I think we first of all have to define what an allergy is. And an allergy really is an exaggerated response to something which should normally be tolerated. So, for example, if you have an allergy to something like dust mite, most people should tolerate that. But if you don't, you can get an allergic nose or even a hyperreactive chest. So an allergy is something that really shouldn't be there, but is there in some people because their immune response is overactive.
We're not all allergic to this. In other words, if you're allergic to dust mites, I might not necessarily be an and all the other allergens that are out there, not everybody's allergic to the same allergens.
100%. So, you know, every single person would have a unique allergy profile. And when we talk about allergies, I think a lot of people think about sniffly, sneezy noses and maybe asthma, but it's a lot more than that in the scope. We focus a lot in athletes on airway diseases because they can impact the performance of athletes. But remember, there are other allergies too. So some people have full-blown anaphylaxis to exercise. So when they exercise, they can actually swell up and get rashes and shortness of breath. Some people
why does that happen? I mean, that is a... That sort of reaction is kind of saying, well, exercise is bad for you in that situation, isn't it?
Yeah, this is very rare. So I'm just trying to elaborate the scope of allergies, that it's not just snotty noses and wheezy chest. So you can actually have full-blown anaphylaxis. It's a rare phenomenon, but we see it, and that can be managed. Allergies can also include food allergies. Some people have the combination of eating certain foods and exercise. That combination triggers them off. Some people have a skin allergy, like a dermatitis, and that could affect a sports person, for example, with certain grips of tennis rackets or golf clubs or pole vaults, etc. Some people get what we call hives or urticaria, and this can be in response to heat or sweating. So that could really affect some athletes. And then you get your sort of ancillary allergies as well, which I see a lot of, but you may not always think about, like a bee sting anaphylaxis. And I see that a lot in cricket players, for example. So I have a whole clinic of 13, 14, 15-year-old boys who come for their bee desensitization, and they're mostly avid cricket players. So the spectrum of allergies is large before we even go into the prevalence. And when we're talking about prevalence, I think we're mainly talking about things like airway disease. So lower airway dysfunction or hyperreactive airway in response to exercise or exacerbated by exercise. And Mike, yes, it is higher in the sports people, especially those sort of supreme athletes and long distance or endurance sports people. So if you take the general population of South Africa, for example, you'll probably find that 10 to 12% of people have asthma. In sports people, statistics which have sort of been brought out by Olympic committees, you'll see that in endurance athletes, this is 20 to 25%. So one in five, one in four people have a reactive chest, which can really impact on their exercise. It's even higher in winter sports people because cold air is an additional trigger for a reactive airway. So your skiers, etc. And even the highest is in aquatic athletes. So swimmers, water polo players, rowers, they seem to have the highest prevalence of a reactive airway, up to 40%.
It's kind of counterintuitive because when you think about sports people, you think about them being healthier than the average population, than the normal population. So, you know, if you've got, I mean, we talk a lot about asthma in cycling, for instance, because there's an overuse of TUEs, and we know about the Chris Froome story being that he's always suffered from asthma. But Ross and I have often discussed this, is that this prevalence of these allergies seems against what you would expect, because if you're going to get to the top level of a sport and you've got an allergy that prevents you being good at it, how do you get to that top level of sport? Is it just because they come through the system because they are sporty, and therefore that's why they present more than their general population, who might not necessarily have access to the medical facilities that a person that's fit has?
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point, how they come through the system. So someone with absolutely severe allergies, so life-threatening asthma or exercise-induced anaphylaxis, probably won't make it through the system. Mm. That's the bottom line. But in those who are fit and healthy and maybe have a small degree of asthma, sometimes the sort of elite sports level can exacerbate that. And there's some interesting reasons for it. So an endurance athlete, for example, a runner, so they spend hours and hours and hours on the road breathing in pollutants, breathing in allergens, breathing in cold air, humid air. So the exposure is just greater. And then there's another very interesting reason, and that's because a lot of athletes, I mean, when we all go for a run, certainly after 100 meters, I'm going, and the mouth opens and the nose doesn't function anymore as our breathing apparatus. So when we mouth breathe, we actually bypass a very, very important part of our airway regulator. That's the nose. The nose is an air conditioner. The nose is a humidifier. The nose traps irritants and pollutants and allergens. and it warms the air and it makes it suitable to go to the chest, which is more fragile. Mm. But when you really are doing endurance sport or high intensity sport, you breathe through your mouth. So the allergens, pollutants, cold air, etc., go straight to your chest, and that can cause your chest to be more twitchy. So I think there's several reasons for it. But as you say, if you are severely debilitated by allergies, you're not going to get to the top. But these are the people with milder allergies, which maybe are exacerbated when you are at the top.
Mm. I mean, it's kind of a design flaw, Ross, isn't it? The big guy upstairs got that wrong because he said, well, when you exercise, which should be a healthy pursuit, in effect, you're putting yourself at risk of some sort of reaction.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about that from an evolutionary point of view.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is it doesn't affect performance enough to filter it out, right? And so it doesn't have any impact on survival because the other people in your clan or tribe would have done the hunting.
Yes.
So, yeah. Do you think the prevalence in the general population is underestimated for the same reason that athletes are more likely to know about it? Is that a lot of people who don't exercise may have it and never discover that?
It's possible because certainly exercise itself is a trigger for asthma or hyperactive airways. So maybe some people just don't exercise enough to know about it. But I truly believe that elite athletes do have a higher prevalence for the reasons that we've described. And that doesn't mean to say it's not well managed because, of course, management is key.
Does an asthmatic athlete, how often would they experience the condition when they exercise? Every time, or do you get instances where it's one every 10 sessions, perhaps it's 1 month a year because of the allergens in the air that month? I mean, how does it present is basically what I'm getting
at. Yeah, so that varies from athlete to athlete, and it varies according to your control. So in theory, if you're well controlled and you go to a good physician or an allergist and you have a good controller, then you shouldn't really get affected that badly when you are on your medication. But you mentioned that certain triggers may make it worse for certain people, and that's absolutely right. Mm. So I have a whole group of young men in my practice. Essentially, I'm a pediatric allergist, but I have a whole group who in winter come to me with a tight chest, and I've named it winter asthma, rugby asthma, because they're generally the rugby players who play in the cold weather and have short, sharp bursts of exercise. Mm. So often the cold is a trigger. Mm. Other triggers are, as you say, your particular allergen. So if it's grass pollen season and you're very allergic to pollen, that could be your worst time of the year. Interestingly, with exercise and reactive airways and immune responses, some ancillary factors can also play a role. For example, in women, the time of the month. If you're menstruating, you're more likely to be reactive. Some people need to eat certain foods to be reactive, like wheat. Some people, if there's a lot of pollution around, they will get triggered. So this will vary from athlete to athlete according to what their main risk factors are.
What is the trigger for the aquatic sports having the highest prevalence?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because I understand the winter sports because I grew up near Johannesburg where it's considerably colder than Cape Town and warmer than many places you are listening to this. But I don't understand the aquatics because somewhere deep in the recesses of my brain when I was doing honors, I remember being told that for asthmatics, swimming is recommended as quite a good form of exercise because of the rhythmical breathing.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I will have to put my hand up and say I'm not 100% sure of all the reasons, but this is the reading I've done. But I would imagine that part of it is actually the chlorine as an irritant, especially in big pools, etc., where lots of people are swimming. They're obviously quite high chlorine levels, and that's a strong irritant of the airway, which in addition to possibly the sudden onset of cold as you jump into the water, that is another trigger. Mm. But on the other hand, when we talk about lung functions and stuff, you'll find that the aquatics have the highest lung function as well. Yeah. So it's obviously good for the chest as
well.
So
just on that, before I get on to the next question, just in support of what you've said, your stats were almost perfect. There's a paper came out at the beginning of this year called Prevalence of Lower Airway Dysfunction in Athletes. That's the first part. And it is a systematic review. So what they do there is they look at all the published literature, they choose the best studies, and then they combine them into one big finding. And the prevalence in winter sports is 39.9%. Sorry, aquatic sports, 39.9%. Winter sports, 29.5%. And elite endurance athletes, 25.1%. So that is the case. Now, if I'm a swimmer and I'm triggered by the chlorine or getting into the water, how do I ever test it on the land to confirm that I have it? Because it's presumably I come to your offices now, your clinic, and I say I can't breathe. How do you simulate that if that's my trigger and I don't have it now with you?
Yeah, so, as in all medicine, you have to take a very thorough history. Mm. And I always say that's your best test, is always your history and examination. So you might find that there is some background evidence of airway hyperreactivity if you do lung function tests, etc. And then you take the history. So you're not going to challenge a patient. In the olden days, we used to use something called a metacholine challenge test, which is similar to chlorine. It's an airway irritant, but you're not going to do that. So this is more of just taking a really, really good history and maybe having some background evidence of some background asthma with a lung function test, with a peak flow. But a lot of it is based on history. Mm. And we know, and the history is normally very clear. The patient says, no, I'm normally fine. I'm fine if I go for a gentle run, but if I go for a hard cross-country run, I get a little bit tight. Gosh, and when I play water polo, I get tight all the time. So we get that scenario a lot, the short, sharp bursts of exercise in highly chlorinated water.
Okay. Because I've always read and seen in sport, especially, they talk about a test, and it's the FEV1 that is primarily used for the diagnosis. But you're saying that actually a doctor can diagnose asthma without that test because history might tell more.
History tells a lot. Mm. In theory, for asthma, you do a lung function test to confirm it. Mm-hmm. And there are various parameters in a lung function test. Mm. So you've got your lung capacity. You've got your vital capacity. You've got your FEV1, which is your forced expiratory volume in 1 second.
Right.
So all those things can help. But the bottom line, as you mentioned, is if someone is particularly triggered by a particular risk factor, such as chlorine, at baseline, their FEV1 may be absolutely normal. Mm. And then you'll have to rely on history as well.
Yeah. And what is bronchial provocation, direct bronchial provocation? Because in this paper I mentioned, and I will, as always, pop these in the show notes, they talk about the highest prevalence was observed in studies using direct bronchial provocation.
So when you do a lung function test, basically you just, with just normal air, you take a deep breath in and you do a massive breath into a machine, which then tells you your various parameters. When you do a direct bronchial provocation, you actually make a patient breathe in a noxious substance.
Okay.
So in the olden days, we always, not olden days, it makes me sound very old, but one of the classical tests is the metacholine challenge test, where you breathe in a substance called metacholine. And I guess you could do the same with chlorine, that you actually create a chlorine vapor, the patient breathes it in, you take their lung function before that and your lung function after that. Mm. And in theory, to have a reactive airway or bronchoconstriction, you'd see a fall by 15 to 20% in their lung function parameters.
Okay.
So that's a direct challenge.
Mm. Okay.
Which is not often done.
Mm. So let's talk about, I mean, everyone talks about when you've got allergies, medications that you can take and chronic medications and things that asthma pumps and allergy tablets and that sort of thing. So to tell us what those things do, for instance. Now, we know, for instance, if you take an allergy tablet, that's to do with sort of pollutants that are in the air, but you can't take one if you're getting post-exercise asthma, for instance. Are there treatments for things like post-exercise asthma or something like that that you can actually take other than just letting it subside?
100%, Mike. So basically, in the treatment or management of any allergic diseases or chest diseases, the first thing is to make an accurate diagnosis, which we've talked about. And sometimes if there are stimulating factors such as pollen or cold air, we need to try and avoid those triggers as much as possible. So that's number one, make a diagnosis, avoid the exacerbating triggers. And we can talk about some ways and means to do that later. And then third is the pharmacological treatment, so the medical management. And that's divided into two streams. The one is your prevention or your long-term control, which generally requires a daily medication. In some cases, it can be as needed. And then you have your reliever category or your emergency treatment. So actually, the important thing to get right is the controller treatment, which really is usually inhaled pumps or sometimes medications. Often they contain inhaled corticosteroids, which really need not make anybody scared because they go to the chest, they stay in the chest. And they can stabilize your airway. So they work on the inflammatory part, which is actually the main part of a reactive airway. It's not just the muscles tightening. It's the inflammation within the airway that you have to work on a daily basis. So taking a good asthma pump on a long-term basis is a nasal spray in terms of an allergic rhinitis or an antihistamine if you've got hives. So you've got your controller. And then you also need to have your emergency treatment. So, for example, if you're having an asthma attack, you need something that rapidly relaxes the muscles in your airway. And these are a whole group of pumps which are called beta 2 agonists, and they open up your airways rapidly. So you need long-term treatment, short-term treatment, avoidance. And then there's also a whole category of non-pharmacological means where you can actually adapt your training, for example, to reduce your allergic responses or your hyperreactive responses. For example, if you are triggered by the cold, and I say that to a lot of my little patients as well, the sort of the rugby asthma scenario, when you start warming up, wear a scarf around your mouth or wear a mask. I mean, masks are actually fantastic for asthmatics running in the cold. If you are very triggered by pollen and it's the height of the pollen season.
Just to explain why the mask or something around your face helps with asthma?
Just with warming up the temperature of the air that you're breathing in. Okay. So we find that just for the first few minutes, that helps a lot. So you're not suddenly going from a warm indoor environment to this cold outdoor environment and inhaling massive amounts of frosty air. That's a huge trigger for a reactive airway.
So I love the details and the technical stuff. And I feel like the missing piece in my head at the moment is what actually happens when these either allergens or cold air trigger this reaction? Technically, well, what's happening in the airways?
Yeah, sure. So if you just quickly allow me to divert back to how we adapt our training so we can finish that session. Wearing the masks. If you're highly allergic to pollen, for example, and it's a high pollen day, actually exercising indoors is an option, et cetera, et cetera. Avoiding highly polluted areas when you're doing long distance running. So the technical bit. Okay, so the general gist of an allergic reaction is that your body overreacts to something which should be harmless. Okay, so say you have an allergic nose, and that's not to be belittled. Even allergic rhinitis, hay fever, can really impact performance because it can cause nasty side effects. So say I'm allergic to pollen. So I go outside, it's a summer's morning, there are high pollen levels, I breathe in the pollen. Now my body is pre-populated with specific IgE receptors which trap pollen and react to it. So if I breathe in pollen, the pollen particles sit down on my IgE receptors, and that triggers my allergy cells, which are called mast cells, to release a whole lot of mediators or chemicals. And many of those chemicals are preformed, so they get released quickly, such as histamines or leukotrienes or prostaglandins. And they can cause things like mucus overproduction, bronchoconstriction, smooth muscle constriction, runny noses, congestion, blood vessels really puff up, and you can get a congested nose or a blocked chest. And then you also get a whole bunch of mediators which are later released. So say I'm allergic to pollen, I go out in the morning, I have a massive sort of sneezing attack and coughing attack, and my nose is running, and my nose is all blocked up. It's not going to suddenly go away within half an hour, because then the delayed inflammatory response comes in, which can affect me for another few hours afterwards. So that's the gist of an allergic response. A whole lot of mediators are released in response to what you are hyperreactive to.
There must be a benefit to that, though. Yeah. The body's doing that for a reason. What is it trying to achieve?
Oh, you really like your technical stuff, eh? So the benefit is absolutely zero. But the initial benefit was that this IgE-mediated response was actually initially a response to parasites. So when we are dealing with parasites, this whole response is advantageous because we're getting rid of the parasite. An allergy is an apparent immune response, so it's a wrong immune response. To parasites, it would be correct because we're getting rid of the parasite. But to allergens, it's incorrect because actually we should be tolerating those allergens. They actually aren't harmful in most people.
Yeah.
So as I said, it's an incorrect response of the immune system trying to get rid of that allergen by overproducing mucus, etc. Just like we do to a virus, for example. We feel lousy because our body's trying to get rid of that virus. But from an evolutionary point of view, etc., there's really no advantage. It's the immune system gone wrong.
So there's no downside to stopping it from happening. I ask that because, for instance, we talk about muscle damage from exercise, and you actually want some degree of inflammation because that's what repairs and that's what then builds up resistance to future damage. Is there any such concept when it comes to allergies?
Directly, no. Indirectly, if you're using allergen immunotherapy as a treatment, yes, but that's a whole different topic. So, for example, some people with a severe grass pollen allergy or a severe house dust mite allergy, so you're really suffering despite medical treatment, we often use the concept of desensitization or immunotherapy, and that's the only time when we expose them to small amounts of the allergen in a safe form, so either injectable or a sublingual under the tongue, you know, on a regular basis, so that the body shifts from disliking that allergen into accepting that allergen. So under those circumstances, yes, controlled exposure is good. But generally, no, allergies really don't have any benefit to the patient.
So you're saying that that some allergens you can adapt your body to accept them. I mean, does that apply to, you know, pollutants like pollen, for instance? I mean, can you get used to the pollen if you're seriously allergic to something?
Yes, you can. So sometimes allergies just automatically reduce over time. So that can happen. So, you know, sometimes the parents in my practice say, oh, I used to have this as a kid and now I've outgrown it. Sometimes it happens naturally. Sometimes we have to help it pharmacologically. So if you have a very severe environmental allergy, then we can actually give you that allergen that you're allergic to, as I said, in a safe form. So sublingual under the tongue or injectable. And these are, you know, very purified extracts of those allergens in tiny, tiny amounts. So the concept of desensitization, which we also do to bee stings, by the way, I was talking about all my cricket playing boys, is giving the thing that you're actually allergic to in a minuscule amount and increasing sometimes over time to stimulate your body into producing those chemical responses which are more accepting of that allergen. This concept also come across in food allergies. Now we do things like peanut desensitization. So that can be done, and it is an option to really think about in athletes who have a specific allergen that triggers them.
Does the reverse happen? You mentioned an allergy gets less severe over time. Do you get cases where at 35 someone says, I've never had this before, and all of a sudden when I visit my parents and their cat sits on my lap, I'm in trouble?
100%. It can happen.
Spontaneous development.
So like most things in life, we usually say a third disappear, a third persist, and a third get worse. it's sort of those kind of statistics. Asthma can be of adult onset. So first of all, you can get adult onset asthma. And secondly, you can get adult onset allergies. I've seen it a lot when people move from one country to the next. So for example, a lot of South Africans, when I was still younger and in training and stuff, we all went to England for a few years to do some medical stuff or to locum or to travel. And a lot of people who didn't have allergies suddenly developed allergic rhinitis to birch pollen because we don't have much of that in South Africa. So depending on your exposure levels and completely new exposures, you can develop allergies over time. Even food allergies, you can develop often something called oral allergy syndrome, where over time, if you're pollen allergic, your body starts confusing certain parts of certain fruits with pollen, and you start reacting to fruits such as birch pollen and apple or pear, grass pollens and melon or tomatoes.
Speaking of food and coming back to the control of allergies, I'd imagine that diet plays quite an important role in either accentuating or suppressing allergic responses.
Yeah, I think that's a complex topic, and I don't think it's you know, we can just give a straightforward answer to that. So first of all, in rare cases, you have food-associated exercise-induced anaphylaxis. So people only react if they've eaten certain foods, usually wheat, within a few hours before or after the exercise. So then you have to identify that specific food and remove it from the diet at the time of exercise. Otherwise, all sort of inflammatory conditions, including allergens, tend to get worse if you have a very pro-inflammatory diet. So too much processed food, too much sweet food. You know, with my little kids with eczema, I call it the birthday party effect. Often if they've had a complete pig out on sweets and colorants and preservatives, the next day their eczema breaks out. Mm. And that's just an example of how pro-inflammatory some diets are. People with gout, for example, often get inflamed when they've had too many sweet or naughty things to eat. So in athletes, I'd say, you know, an anti-inflammatory diet, which generally is a healthy Mediterranean type, rich in antioxidants, is definitely beneficial.
Mm. I mean, it's quite, I mean, I know we're sort of bouncing between themes here because it is quite fascinating to understand that you can actually do some intervention to get you used to a certain allergen. I mean, is that something that's quite, I mean, I've never heard of that before, and I've suffered from a fish allergy for most of my life, and I've always wondered, is there any way of solving it? And so how easy is it to get a treatment like that? I mean, where would you go if you were suffering from a pollen allergy and you were an athlete and you wanted to kind of get over it? Would you just go to your normal GP, or what would you do?
Yeah, so that depends on where you live. In South Africa, it's really more in the realm of the specialist. So a few ear, nose and throat specialists, but mostly allergists like myself would arrange that. And there are a few allergists in the country, about 12. They're not too many. But we are, you know, on an everyday basis, we deal with desensitizations, bee patients, pollen allergic patients, and we could arrange everything. It's quite complex because you have to get approval of the South African, you know, pharmaceuticals, and then you have to import it in, and we currently do that from Spain. But if you're living in a country such as Spain, Portugal, the United Kingdom, these desensitization tools to ERA allergens are readily available and often even done in the GP practice. So much more than here in South Africa, mainly because of ease of access and availability. And they're costly as well, because for us, they come from overseas. It's a good, you know, few thousand rand a month on a monthly basis for many months.
So it's not the kind of thing where you do it for a couple of weeks and then you're...
No.
It's a long process.
100%. Okay. So generally desensitization, if you want to be optimal for things like grass pollen, house dust mite allergy, is a 3-year process.
Wow. And how often would you do that? Once a month?
So if you are taking it sublingually, which is under the tongue, you're doing it at home, you do it every day. Mm-hmm. And if you are getting injections, so having it injectable forms, it's generally there's a build-up phase. And once you reach a maintenance phase, it's generally about once a month.
So what stops people from doing that, obviously, is cost. And just the fact that it's the time taken.
Time, cost, availability, not knowing about it. Yeah.
Really?
And often one resorts to medical treatment first to see how a patient responds. And if they respond adequately to simple medical treatment, then they generally don't need it or want it.
Because it's not like a vaccine where you go and have a vaccine and it's a once-off vaccine and then you're suddenly, you know, you're protected. It's obviously a longer process.
It's not like a vaccine. It's a long process, shifting your immune system. So in a vaccine, you create antibodies immediately so that you've got a preformed army of antibodies when you encounter that infection. In allergies, it's a slow, steady buildup of changing your immune system from hating the allergen to accepting the allergen. And that requires a whole lot of chemical changes, your antibody structure changes, etc., your antibody response to that allergen.
I notice you haven't said anything about the fish that Mike brought up. Is Mike resigned to not eating fish?
Fish is a curious allergen because you can actually get a fish allergy later in life, which is one of the few food allergies you can develop later in life, sometimes in childhood. But shellfish, for example, we often have our little kids being fine, and then when they're older, in their 20s or 30s, you could develop a shellfish allergy. But because fish is relatively easy to avoid, it hasn't really been on the desensitization radar. We have more candidates for nuts. Nut desensitization is common because nut allergies is everything and it's not commonly outgrown.
Yeah.
And in some cases, milk and egg allergy and wheat allergy, for example, are normally outgrown over time. So we don't do that. But in some cases, if they're persistent, we try and desensitize to milk or egg.
Speaking of nuts, I remember being on a flight once and they announced that there was someone on the plane with a nut allergy. So please, no one should even open a packet that contains peanuts. It can actually be that severe?
Now, there are different degrees of allergies. Yeah. Some people need to consume, say, a teaspoonful of peanut butter before they react. Some people just need to inhale the vapors in the air.
I mean, that's
and
I was amazed. Yeah, I remember thinking, I'm in seat 14B, someone in seat 46F.
Yeah.
Could in theory have a reaction to my peanut. That's why. I mean, that's unbelievable.
It's possible.
So is that person treatable by some kind of desensitization?
Well, I mean, they'd be quite a high risk candidate because obviously of the safety element. Yeah. So you take lots into consideration. Huh. I mean, we prefer to do younger kids because their immune systems are more malleable or moldable. Mm. Older patients, we always, oh dear, because they are more tricky to treat. Mm. And you have to take safety into account because the actual desensitization involves exposure to your allergen. Yeah, I mean, so if you're going to have anaphylaxis every day, it's just not worth it. Yeah. So we choose our patients wisely.
Just even a step before treatment in terms of diagnosis, how long does it take you typically to find the source? Because from what you said this morning, it sounds like quite a lot of investigative work goes into this, bit of trial and error, a lot of interrogation and questioning. How long from start to finish does it take to typically diagnose? Or is it easier than it's made to sound so far?
I think allergies are very undertaught at medical school. So I've been lucky enough to specialize in it in the UK, etc. So it becomes a second nature. But generally, when we have a new allergy patient, we have an hour's consultation, just to give you an example. Mm. We sit down, we take a thorough history, looking at the patterns there, do an examination, and then we embark on allergy tests. And I do a lot of what we call skin prick testing. So, you know, we did right there in the rooms.
So on the forearm.
Various allergens. Yeah. And that takes 15 minutes and then you've got your answer. And then, of course, you need to know how to interpret it. Mm. Some things might be cross-reactivity. For example, I can't tell you the number of patients I get to referred by ENT surgeons who, because the patients had big tonsils and adenoids and they're 12 years of age or whatever, they've done allergy tests and the food allergies have come up to peanuts and soya and wheat. And the patient says, but I've been eating this all my life. Then all I need to say to them is, are you grass pollen allergic? Yes. Okay, it's a cross-reactivity. Mm. It's actually not clinically relevant. So you have to know patterns that's why we have to specialize as allergists. But generally, once we see the allergy tests, we interpret them, we adjust it to the patient, and then we come up with an allergy plan. And that may include preventative treatment, allergen avoidance, possibly talking about desensitization and regular follow-up.
Hmm. So let's move on to the treatments and the things like the allergy tablets, antihistamines that people take. I mean, is that a good solution for athletes? I mean, I think most of the people that are listening to this podcast are probably thinking about it in terms of respiratory issues that they might have. I mean, can you take that all the time for the rest of your life if you struggle with things like pollens and things that affect your lungs?
Yeah, so the bottom line is that there are incredibly safe, effective treatments available for lung or nose-associated allergies. And many people shudder at the thought of taking an inhaled steroid or steroid-based nasal spray. But actually, to put it in perspective, these things are unbelievably safe. You'd have to be taking them for months or years to get the equivalent of one dose of oral cortisone in. Mm. And essentially, they can be taken as long as you need, as long as it's in a sensible dose, which is age appropriate in a sensible form and a sensible combination of medications. So if you need to be on an asthma pump for the rest of your life, that's fine, as long as it's appropriate, an appropriate dose, an appropriate choice that minimizes side effects and maximizes benefit.
And antihistamines? I mean, there's so many on the market these days.
Yeah. So what you want to do with antihistamines come in various generations. The older generation have got their dirty drugs, we call them. They've got side effects. They can make you drowsy. They can make you lousy. Yep. They can dry out your mucous membranes. But the newer generations, or the even newer generations, are incredibly safe medications. So they can be taken long-term. The ideal scenario for allergy control is that your long-term controller is so good that you don't need your reliever that much.
Yeah.
And in theory, in asthma, your reliever is a quick-acting bronchodilator, and in allergic rhinitis, your reliever is an antihistamine. Mm. So ideally, you get to the stage through allergen reduction and use of appropriate nose sprays that you don't need it every day. But these medications are incredibly safe if you choose the right ones.
So if you're taking antihistamine, for instance, every single day, there are lots of ones on the market at the moment, can you stick with the same one? I've heard different stories about the fact that you can't stay on the same antihistamine because it loses its effect after time. You must switch antihistamine pills because they give a slightly different effect. I mean, how would you use an antihistamine and how would you use it sustainably?
So first of all, I would say make sure you've got the correct diagnosis, because it might be that you're getting the diagnosis all wrong and that you're getting a series of common colds, for example, in kids. That's very common. The parents think they've got allergies, but actually they're just getting viruses. Have yourself tested, confirm the allergy, confirm what you're allergic to. If, for example, you're allergic to house dust mite, then some simple strategies such as mattress cleaning or bed covers or reducing your fluffy toys, hot washing your stuff may be enough to alleviate a lot of your symptoms. But if not, then you go on medications. In terms of your question about antihistamines, actually, no. That's a bit of an old wives tale. Antihistamines are effective and can be taken long term, and you don't need to chop and change. The reason for a deterioration is normally something ancillary. So either your allergen levels are high, for example, it's pollen season, or you haven't been taking your medication correctly, or you haven't been taking a nasal spray. For example, antihistamines are great for itching and sneezing, but not very good for a blocked nose. So you need to have the right combination of meds, or you might be sick and have a virus or a sinusitis, which is mimicking your allergy symptoms. So generally, it's other things that are worsening your allergies.
So some of the antihistamines, because this is a sports podcast worth pointing out, they do get you banned. Because they contain, for instance, pseudoephedrine or other banned substances.
But that's not an antihistamine. That's a decongestant. So a pure antihistamine would not be banned.
Okay. Because there was a famous case in the Sochi Winter Olympics 2014 of a Swedish ice hockey player who got banned. I remember reading. And that was for pseudoephedrine, which was prescribed to him for sinusitis, was what they said it was.
So obviously any elite athlete has to be very careful. Yeah. But your pure medications, such as pure new generation antihistamines and your asthma pumps and your allergic rhinitis sprays are in a particular dose range, absolutely acceptable. But what you need to be aware of is that things like systemic corticosteroids would get you banned.
Yeah, of course.
And that happens when you are badly controlled and you need a course of steroids. So even more reason to have your proper day-to-day control that you don't need your emergency steroids. Pseudoephedrine unfortunately comes in a lot of cold and flu medication. It's not an antihistamine at all, but it's often combined with an antihistamine and often with old-fashioned antihistamines, which dry out your secretions. Yeah. And of course, your pseudoephedrine makes you feel great because suddenly your nose is unblocked. But 4 hours later, you return with a hugely blocked nose. Yeah. So do be aware of those.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it gives me a bit of a conspiracy theory, because you talk about all these treatments that are available, and yet we still see particularly in the cycling side, lots of top athletes take these medications. And is it fair to say that if you're under the right medical advice, you shouldn't have any risk of being caught with a banned substance, because there are so many options available to treat things like asthma in athletes?
Absolutely. In preparing for this talk, I had a really just quick look at the anti-doping websites, etc., because it's not exactly my field of expertise. And I was very happy to see that normal, asthma preventer pumps in moderate doses are absolutely acceptable, which is what you need, mild to moderate doses for most patients. Antihistamines are acceptable. Things like systemic corticosteroids are not. Things like pseudoephedrine are not. So I think those lists are available, and you can absolutely treat your patients without using any banned substances, unless you're trying to cheat.
Right. Well, there we go.
That's the key. That's the key, Brett. Can we just, while staying on the topic of exercise, there's a difference, I gather, between exercise-induced bronchoconstriction and asthma. What's the differential diagnostic criteria there between those two things? And maybe you can explain what they are. Well, we've covered asthma, but...
Great. So asthma is a hyperreactivity of the airway in response to various stimuli, and which leads to inflammation and muscle constriction in your airways. Mm. Now, you could actually argue that exercise-induced asthma is a subgroup of asthma. Mm-hmm. So these patients are triggered mostly by exercise, whereas in other forms of asthma, you might be triggered by cold air, by laughing, by viruses. In exercise-induced asthma, they're purely triggered by exercise.
Okay. It's not like they're different by severity.
No, you can have a severe attack when you're exercising. So depending on how frequently you get attacks, then you would decide on the treatment. Mm. So some people would say, look, if you have one exercise-induced attack per year when you're running your heaviest cross-country race, then you can actually just pre-dose yourself before that race. Mm. But if you have regular symptoms, then you want to be on a regular controller inhaler. Mm.
Those inhalers, I gather in South Africa, you can walk into a pharmacy and leave with one without a prescription.
No. Yes and no.
So it depends
for a bronchodilator, which is a problem, because some people just use a bronchodilator whenever they need it. And our recent asthma guidelines in 2019 have been turned totally 180 degrees to say that's absolutely wrong. You cannot just use a bronchodilator on its own ever. So the new way to treat asthma is either you need to be on a controller in the background and then use your bronchodilator when needed, or every time you use a bronchodilator, you need to use a controller at the same time. Okay. So a problem and a massive cause of poor asthma control and even asthma-related deaths is patients who do not treat their asthma properly but just take quick-acting relievers as needed. And you can actually see, when we see patients and assess their control, we ask, how much Astavent do you use as a brand of salbutamol or a bronchodilator that's commonly used in South Africa? And by hearing their answer, we can hear how their control actually is. And it's a real problem. If someone's using a canister or two a month, they are at risk of life-threatening asthma attacks.
Worse than if they were using nothing. Or is it that they're using it thinking that it's working and actually it's just ineffective?
It is working for quick relief. But in the meantime, the inflammation in your lung is getting worse and worse and worse. So it only attacks it only relaxes the muscle. It does nothing to the inflammation. Yeah. And we've really worked long and hard on identifying asthma and allergic rhinitis, any of these respiratory allergies as predominantly inflammatory conditions.
Let's move on to something slightly different, and that obviously one of your areas of speciality is particularly around lungs. What do we know about lungs and people who are active? Can you actually make your lungs healthier? And if your lungs are healthier as an active person, how much more healthy are they compared to somebody who's sedentary?
I think in general, obviously, we know the many benefits of exercise, physical, emotional, it's sort of an anti-inflammatory and a mood enhancer. So we can never deny that. But it's an interesting fact, actually, Mike, that not all exercise increases your lung capacity. So a lot of exercises, we can pretty much predict, like I can look at you and say, this is your height, you're a male, this is how old you are, and then blow into a spirometer or a peak flow machine, and we can predict what you should be blowing. And there are many charts for that. So that actually stays the same for athletes. We can mostly predict on gender, height, and age what their lung capacity is. Now, there are certain sports which have actually been associated with an increased lung capacity, but not all sports. And these sports are often, I believe, the rowers, the swimmers, and for some reason, basketball players. So, but not necessarily the runners. So someone like Michael Phelps, apparently, our lung capacity, well, you two, because you're males, would be about 6 liters. That's how much air your lungs, both lungs together, can hold. You don't breathe 6 liters every time because you only use a tidal volume. But apparently Michael Phelps's total lung capacity is about 12 liters, so double that. So some swimmers can have incredible lung capacity.
Arguably they're selected to swim. They don't develop the lung from swimming. Or is it a combination of both.
But certainly some sports, as I said, have been associated with increased lung capacity, but some sports have not. And remember, everybody gets breathless. We always think when we're breathless, we're unfit. The reason why we breathe fast during exercise is because our muscles are requiring more oxygen and getting rid of more carbon dioxide. That sends a message to our brain and our respiratory center to say, breathe faster so we can move more air. So it's normal to get breathless, even if you're an elite athlete. If you looked at the Commonwealth Games at the end of the 5,000 meters, they're absolutely exhausted, no matter how fit they are, because your breathing rate goes, you breathe in and out, even up to sort of 100 liters a minute if you are doing high intensity sport. But as your muscles get fitter from training, they are more efficient with their oxygen and carbon dioxide, and that's why you don't get as tired when you are fit, because your muscles are fit, not necessarily because your lungs are fit.
When you say your muscles, in other words, the muscles that control your breathing in your chest. And
your muscles
chest
all over your body. Your leg muscles, they're more efficient. They don't need as much oxygen. They don't need to get rid of as much carbon dioxide because they're trained.
Yeah, and the carbon dioxide buildup's not as large either.
Yeah.
I mean, do fit lungs, are fit lungs generally bigger, or are they the same and just more efficient?
I'm a bit out of my depth about the average, but you know, just the answer that only certain sports increase your lung capacity would make me think that fit lungs are also just more efficient. But I don't know what you think about that.
I've read,
Ross.
Yeah, I've read that your ability to recruit the alveoli improves with training. So you can explain a little bit more about the mechanistic side of that and the anatomical aspects. But remember, the gas exchange happens at the level of these little air sacs called alveoli. And I've read anyway that it's certainly not my area. But that the recruitment of alveoli is improved, the circulation to them is improved, and so the exchange of gas gets better. But the actual anatomical structure of the lung isn't really affected much by exercise. It's one of the few systems where exercise doesn't change it. It changes how it works, but not it.
That's interesting, isn't it? You would have thought you would get bigger lungs, but you're right. You can't necessarily get bigger lungs. You can get more efficient lungs.
Yeah. And I think, so again, it's like your Stephen Redgrave, I remember seeing stats on. Massive lungs, rowers, the swimmers.
But that's probably genetic.
It'll be a combination of genetic and potentially the training that they do in some instances changes that. I would not know why some sports do it and some sports don't, though.
There was a great story about Miguel Indurain. Apparently, you had oversized lungs, supposedly. But I suppose that would be, were born with that.
It's the same. I mean, like Phelps's arms, his lungs, his big feet. These stories become folklore. Legend. And they're probably people's attempt to explain complicated things in simple ways. And they don't always capture everything.
Yeah.
I was going to mention one other thing about the lungs, but the respiratory muscles must improve through training. So, for instance, the ability to actually activate the diaphragm and the intercostals, that would be improved. Can you target train those in someone who needs to breathe more deeply?
Yeah, are there breathing exercises?
Once again, as an allergist, this is probably beyond my field of expertise, but I would imagine that one can, and maybe we can get input from someone else about that. But I would imagine with the correct breathing techniques, especially for swimmers, I mean, you need good breathing technique, especially if you're sprinting the 50 meters without breathing once. So I would imagine that there are some specific exercises and techniques which help with the breathing.
I always wondered where the rate limiting step is from the nose to the blood. And I remember seeing people wearing those little strips on their noses. Yes. You've seen that.
Yes.
I used to think that there's never been something as useless as that.
Yeah.
Because that's not where the limit is.
Yeah. But then you see Galanina Schurter, who's, you know, the world's best mountain biker, who still wears those every single time he races.
Yeah,
so
they wear power balance bracelets for the magnetic aura it gives them as well.
But there's a fantastic placebo effect. Don't ever forget that.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, they'll put their socks on in certain order every morning and wear one red, one black sock. That doesn't have a benefit, but it does.
It does.
Psychology's got a lot to do with it.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. There's the part of psychology. And that is important, because if people panic or become anxious, then obviously your breathing will be affected.
You mentioned very, very briefly there the difference between lung size based on whether you're male or female. Just to delve into that slightly more, are you saying that men's lungs tend to be bigger than females' lungs relative to body size?
Absolutely.
Are they?
Yeah.
Okay.
So if
there's a man and a woman next to each other of the same size, would you generally find the male lungs will be bigger than the female lungs?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So when we do charts for lung functions, either for spirometry or just a simple peak flow, which is an office tool, the chart is different for men and women, girls and boys, and also with every age group, you know, within every 2 years of age, or in adults every 5 years of age, it changes, and also height. So I'm fairly short, so my lung capacity, female in my 40s, so my projected lung capacity is only about 400 liters, my peak flow, liters per minute, whereas yours would probably be around 540, 550 to 600. So there's a big difference in baseline expectations.
It's not exactly always about how much air you can get in. It's also about the ability to expel it as well, isn't it? Because I remember I've done a peak flow test and said
it's an expiration test.
I wasn't bad with the inhaling, but the exhaling wasn't as... Well, yeah. I was slightly, what's the word when you're breathing in too much and you're over-breathing? People used to breathe into a bag.
Hyperventilate.
Slightly hyperventilate. So, can you measure things like hyperventilation versus inhaling?
Yeah, you're talking about spirometry now, because that's a more specific breathing test where you breathe in and you blow out, whereas a simple peak flow, you just blow out, and that's a nice office tool. So yeah, the spirometer produces certain patterns in certain pathology. So you can see that the loop of an asthmatic is different to the loop of someone with chronic bronchitis or emphysema is different to someone who's got a tracheal problem at the top of the airway. So yes, you can see that. Hyperventilation, I'm sure there'd be a pattern for that as well.
Yeah. I mean, is it, I mean, I guess, could you predict somebody's athletic performance based on a simple spirometer test when they were 13 years old, for instance?
If they have certain numbers? Think so. No, there are too many other factors. Ross will know better than me. Their types of muscles, their genetics, their psyche. There's a whole, I mean, genetics must play a huge role, and muscle fibers and things like that. So
your lung
function
isn't
not
necessarily a final determinant of athletic performance, because it's just one of many factors.
One of many factors, but you can use it obviously to gauge their, if they have asthma, etc., how good their control is.
Yeah.
Or how much intervention they need.
So you'd say it's necessary but not sufficient. Like, in other words, if you didn't have functioning lungs, then you've got a problem.
Yes.
But as long as you do, there's 500 other things you need.
Yeah. All right, Dr. Claudia Gray, thank you very much for your time. It's been quite fascinating talking to you. I'm going to go off and take my antihistamine very shortly. Hopefully, I know it's not going to improve my lung function, but maybe make me a little bit more comfortable. But thank you very much.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Follow the Science of Sport podcast at Sports SciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.